From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dratzer in Albany. Hey, Eric, so it's just you and me this week as Mark goes traipsing through India.
Mark goes traipsing through India, and I go traipsing through the post-industrial landscape of upstate New York.
Ooh, I'm so jealous.
Yeah, I know you are.
So, let's see. You know, just because they have holidays doesn't mean the U.S. stops bombing and scheming and pulling all of this other stuff around the world. What's happened in the last week that you want to talk about?
Well, there's a bunch of things to talk about, but I suppose the news that's really dominated the headlines in the last, 48 to 72 hours, I guess, is the news of the killing or the assassination, I suppose we could say, of one of the principal commanders of the, of Jaish al-Islam in Syria, but really one of the principal commanders of the entire, so-called rebel opposition or terrorists, whatever you want to call them, a man named Alush, Zahran Alush, who is in many ways regarded as one of the leading figures in the anti-Assad side of this war. And so the story that we're hearing, actually, originally it was reported, and I'm curious what you've read on this, Don, but originally this was reported as an airstrike carried out by the Russians in the Damascus suburbs in around Ghouta and Douma, where the Jaish al-Islam has been really kind of controlling that territory for a few years now. Supposedly the Russians had carried out an airstrike, allegedly with the intelligence provided by the Syrians, by their Syrian allies. But in the last 48 hours, the news has changed a bit, at least from what I've read. Sources I've read are now saying that, in fact, it was carried out by Syrian Air Force and Syrian intelligence. And that, I think, is significant. There's, I think, a qualitative difference between this being carried out by the Russians solely from the air and this being carried out on the ground, an inside job, if you will. I know Iranian media outlets and a few others, including, of course, those from Syria, are now calling this, an intelligence operation where at least one, if not more than one, individual penetrated the inner circle of Alush and these other commanders at the top of the food chain there, and basically provided all of the inside information, because these guys are not dumb. You know, they're not moving exactly out in the open where the Russians could just strike at them at will, or where the Assad government, the Syrian Arab Army, could strike at them at will. Instead, I think this required much more specific knowledge, and it seems to be that is what happened. Now, whether or not we can really 100% put all of our eggs in the Iranian media outlet basket, I don't know that we can. They've been wrong before, but
like everyone,
I see multiple sources confirming this.
Yeah, like everyone.
Exactly.
As these things break, you have no primary sources usually. You're, trying to go off of second and third-hand information. What I saw, you asked me what I saw yesterday on CNN on the crawl about midday. I saw, a report that he had been killed. And they didn't attribute, they said that there was a report that it was from an airstrike. It was unknown if it was Russian or Syrian. That's what they said. And
CNN was saying they it was unknown
on the crawl. Yeah, now that was about midday. I guess about midday yesterday. Then
just to clarify, when you say yesterday, you mean Saturday, December 26th.
Yeah, the 26th Saturday. And then I started to see accusations, floated about that it was the Russians targeting, the moderate opposition, quote unquote, that this was a leading opponent to Assad, and this was an assassination as they go into the negotiating phase next month of the workout of this whole almost 5-year catastrophe there, and then today I saw, you know, where it was attributed to the Syrian Arab army, and more or less consensus in the international media about that. So I don't know what happened. But
so
that's
okay,
what
so
I've
great.
Seen.
So then the Iranian report that I read more than 24 hours ago has basically been confirmed by other media outlets internationally.
Right, and of course now we have the context. If it was the Russians in an airstrike, there's both the, you know, whatever the military implications that you started probing before are, you know, whether they have people inside or if it was just an airstrike and they, you know, got lucky or whatever. And it was the Russians, of course, then there's this political argument that the U.S. says that they're basically trying to position the post-conflict period so that Assad is the only leader that can emerge. If it's the Syrians, though, it is an entirely legitimate act for the Syrian Arab army, the Syrian government, to take out the leader of a group that has been waging war against it, whether they're Syrians or from Mars.
Well, yeah, and look, not only that, I mean, it's one thing to say in the midst of this war, of course, the Syrian Arab army has every right to attempt to destroy those that it opposes or that those that have been waging war against the Syrian state. But I would go one step further and just remind listeners that this group was operating in Douma and in Ghouta, the suburbs of Damascus, precisely those places where the chemical weapons attack of summer 2013 happened, which originally was falsely attributed, and they still falsely attribute it to the Syrian government, even though that's been empirically disproven and disproven even just by the political circumstances. That whole narrative has been debunked, and it's now, at least among people in the know, and I've spoken to people who are both pro and anti-Assad, and they've pretty much come to a consensus as far as the fact that the chemical weapon attack was most likely carried out by one of the terror groups that was operating in that region, whether it was the Nusra Front, whether it was Jaish al-Islam, or what have you. On top of that, a lot of the rockets that have been raining down onto Damascus, the shelling, I should say, of Damascus, has come from precisely those strongholds controlled by Jaish al-Islam. So there is a very real, so to speak, clear and present reason why the Syrian Arab army would want to target this individual and want to target this group, if for no other reason than the protection of Damascus and the protection of millions of people in Syria. I also, if you don't mind, Don, I'd like to shift a little bit and just mention the ramifications of all of this on the ground, because I think that's important, and I don't want to understate the significance of Alush and Jaish al-Islam and what this actually means. Because, in fact, if you look at a map, a map of Syria, a map of this conflict, the majority of the airstrikes that are carried out by the Russians, the majority of that fighting is now happening more or less nearish the Turkish border. So we're talking about the corridor separating, Idlib, Hama, and Latakia, in the northern parts of the country. Now, you have to go much further south to get to Damascus and to get to these suburbs of Damascus. And down there, the Russian airstrikes become increasingly sparse, and it is much more the Syrian Arab army and perhaps Hezbollah in a much more limited capacity that has been fighting down there. And a lot of that fighting in the entire southern tier of the country has been against Jaish al-Islam, the Islamic Army of Conquest, and some of these other groups that have been allied with each other. Now, I think that this killing opens up a very real potential for the collapse of the entire southern corridor of this war, wherein the Syrian government can reassert control of a huge swath of the country. Because if we're to believe even the Western media reports about Alush and his organization, I read an interview conducted with him from the Daily Beast. I don't know, what was that, maybe 6 months ago at the most, not even. And he was described as basically a strong man, as someone who was holding together a very shaky coalition of groups solely by the force of his will and the force of his, I guess, depending on your perspective, either ferocity or brutality. And the fact that he's been killed, and not just him, but really a huge segment of the leadership of this coalition, the fact that they're out of the picture now tells me there is a real potential for this whole thing to collapse. And if so, if that happens, that means the war becomes relegated to a large extent in the northern corridor near the Turkish border, particularly Al-Qaeda, the Al-Nusra Front, and then further, you know, further north and east, the Islamic State towards Raqqa. So this can change significantly the entire complexion of this war.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned that the Russians have been focused up along closer to the Turkish border and Aleppo, Raqqa, up in the northern part of the country. Those, of course, the areas that have been the supply line from Turkey for weapons and for troops both coming in and retreating that have been fighting in the north. And the ability of ISIL and whatever other groups are fighting up in that area has been to do so has been significantly, I would say, primarily degraded by the Russian attacks, whereas the advances that are taking place now in the south are possible because the Syrian Arab Army is able to focus more or less on one front instead of two. They were fighting a two-front war, essentially, in the south and the north.
Yep.
And now that's not the case. And you have Iraq joining the fight, really, now at this point against ISIL. ISIL is fighting a two-front war now, or even a three-front war if you count those Kurds that are fighting ISIS as well.
Well, and I've heard some speculation, too, that the two- or three-front nature of the war for the Islamic State is part of the reason why Turkey sent its troops into Iraq, why Turkey is sending troops into Syria, why Turkey is expanding its military presence in order to take pressure off of the Islamic State, which, you know, it's interesting because now it's almost a consensus internationally, even among the, you know, most stridently anti-Assad media outlets and anti-Assad, political analysts and geopolitical analysts, that more or less the Islamic State is a proxy of Turkey, that they are, if not directly, at least indirectly, in the employ of the Turkish government. And so in many ways, we could say that Turkey's insertion of troops is like a pressure release valve for ISIS.
You know, one of the things that they haven't quite come around to in the West, however, is probing the role to which Turkey is acting as a proxy for the United States.
Well, that for sure. But, you know, now that we're talking a more a longer, decades-long process. And matter of fact, I was just having a conversation the other day with somebody about the nature of the political situation in Turkey. And I don't necessarily need to, shift the entire conversation here. But I will say that what we're seeing now in Turkey is very interesting because, in fact, there are three major camps politically in Turkey that I think are in many ways doing battle for control. Now, it's sad to say this, but probably undoubtedly the least influential of the three is the, you know, Kemalist faction, the Turkish nationalist, secularist, pro-military faction, which more or less had been governing that country for a number of decades, really since the time of Ataturk. But in recent times, I think the nature of the politics of Turkey has shifted such that the real battle for control politically is between the Erdogan camp, which is the Muslim Brotherhood, that is the AKP, the Justice and Development Party, the political Islam wing of the body politic of Turkey, as expressed, as illustrated and embodied by Erdogan and Davutoğlu and their neo-Ottoman outlook for the region and for Turkey's role in the world. that's on one side. The other side, the other major camp here that I think gets almost no attention really at all in the West is the Gulenist camp. That is Fethullah Gulen and his network. Fethullah Gulen is a billionaire Turkish businessman, entrepreneur, owner of massive networks of charter schools throughout the U.S., throughout the world. Somebody who is reputedly very close, if not directly in bed with the CIA, somebody who has been long-standing ties to Langley. I believe he lives in the D.C. suburbs or something like that. And this struggle for power between Gulen and Erdogan is, I think, the backdrop to a lot of the developments inside of Turkey, because, of course, Erdogan is constantly harping on Gulen, a Gulenist conspiracy against the Turkish government, that this is a conspiracy organized by Fethullah Gulen and his agents and proxies.
His media holdings there, too. I mean, they shut down his media. They shut down his media, too. I mean, that was a big thing about a month and a half ago, I think, that when they made the raids, they arrested 75 people and shut down one of his media outlets.
Well, and a few of his media outlets, in fact, are some of the best media outlets on Turkey, especially one of the most popular internationally is today's Zaman. And Zaman is, that's in the Gulen network. I don't know if he directly owns it or not. So, maybe I shouldn't say that, but certainly it's within the orbit of Gulen's influence. And so, yes, a lot of the repression of journalists and media inside of Turkey by Erdogan, aside from being an obvious violation of human rights and the Geneva Convention and all the rest of that, it is in many ways justified by Erdogan's camp as being a defensive move against Gulen and, I think, reading between the lines a little bit, against the U.S. intelligence networks that Gulen works with. So there's a political backdrop to this entire Turkish angle of the Syria war that I think is deliberately concealed in the West.
And then there's the situation, the relationship between Erdogan and Qatar and the Saudis.
Yeah, and again, I mean, a lot of this has to do with regional influence, regional hegemony. As I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, this neo-Ottoman outlook that Erdogan really espouses, I think a fundamental feature of that, I guess, a principal tenet of that is that Turkey must become a regional hegemon. Now, that necessarily puts Turkey into conflict with a number of players in the region, obviously into conflict with Iran, obviously into conflict with, in varying degrees, Saudi Arabia. And that's part of the reason why, for Erdogan, he sees the war in Syria, the regime change operation against a legitimate government, as really a central element of this broader regional strategy. And now this question of whether or not Turkey is entirely a U.S. proxy, I think it's somewhat debatable, because I don't think the United States is 100% in love with everything that Erdogan is doing, especially since he's putting a lot of these U.S. allies, especially Saudi Arabia, into a very complicated, very difficult situation. That just reminded me, we have to talk about Saudi Arabia, because, of course, Saudi Arabia is the principal financier of Alusha's organization, Jaish al-Islam, and this coalition of groups that Alusha's really been the leader of. And all of them were just in Saudi Arabia, I think, less than 10 days ago, right, for this massive, convocation of the so-called counterterrorism coalition that Saudi Arabia was putting together. And so there's a lot of these ties between these groups and a lot of these issues connecting these various countries that really have to be explored, which is why, I don't know how people feel about this, but you and I and Mark are talking about Syria the majority of the episode every single week.
Yeah, I mean, a week ago Friday was the announcement of the framework for the peace talks. The day before that, was the UN Security Council resolution on terrorism. That was so a week ago Thursday. And I believe either the Wednesday or the Tuesday before was when they were in Riyadh and had announced this thing, because it was sort of coloring what had happened on Thursday and Friday. So, and then yesterday is 10 days later or 9 days later, this guy's gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of breathtaking how quickly things are changing, especially in light of all of this. And again, I would just stress this point, you know, there was a lot of talk, and it's now been confirmed, about the chemical weapons that were sent into Syria that were used on August 21st, 2013, and where those chemical weapons came from. Now, I remember writing about it. It happened, I guess, August 21st. I was writing about it August 22nd, 2013. And I remember the reports already coming out at the time about potentially the role of the Saudis and Saudi intelligence in particular. Prince Bandar bin Sultan, Bandar being the coordinator that sent sarin gas into Syria via Turkey. And then, of course, many months later, Seymour Hersh's article, the red line and the rat line, which confirmed, based on his wide network of high-level sources, that sarin had originated in not that it had originated, but that it had transited through Turkey on its way into Syria. Now, there is this real question here as to who exactly was sending those chemical weapons in, and there it is the matter of some debate. But regardless of exactly who did, we can see the inextricable link between Saudi Arabia as a coordinator and financier, and Turkey as the on-the-ground, handlers of this network of terrorism that is waging war against the Syrian state.
You know, it must be nice to sit in Langley or in the Pentagon or in the White House or wherever these characters, plant their behinds while they develop this stuff, and know that you have, Saudi money and Qatari money and troops from Qatar, command and control capacity, NATO bases, and compliant networks inside of Turkey, political cover from Jordan, the Israelis ready to blow something up at the drop of a hat to act like the wild card, Kurds that are compliant, Barzani, etc., surrounding this whole theater before you even put your hands in it. What power?
Yeah, and this, I think, what you're getting at, this picture you're painting, illustrates clearly that the nature of call it controlled chaos that the United States can employ, because with all of those factors, all of those elements, which are obviously in the pocket of the United States, but of course also have their own motives, their own ideas, their own interests, and so forth, that once the U.S. just unleashes them to do their own thing, whatever their own thing might be, that is already a situation of controlled chaos, because you're essentially allowing this sort of maelstrom of violence and killing and war to take place under the auspices of, being hands-off. And I think that in many ways it allows the United States to present itself as having, clean hands in all of this, when in fact, of course, I think as you mentioned and as we should all know by now, the United States is the principal instigator of this war.
Well, what's interesting is that is exactly the thing that's changed with the entrance of Russia into this, because... Yep. As the U.S. Saw its, first of all, people were able to witness over the last year and change the tremendous capacity that the United States has for doing surveillance, for example. I'm certain that every person speaking in a tent anywhere in Iraq, Syria, or anywhere in the region, if they want to, there's a little channel you dial up and you can listen to the conversation in Langley. But for some reason, this huge supply of troops, first of all, marching across the desert in Toyotas as it converged on city after city, nobody saw it, nobody did anything about it. while a bombing campaign was supposedly going on. Endless examples of that, up to and including the one exposed by the Russians with the Putin called the truck pipeline. And now suddenly, where these people were all free to come out and take a tour, basically, in a Toyota across the desert, now if they come out for a minute to visit Riyadh, you know, within a week of them coming back, they get blown up.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it has fundamentally changed the nature of this war, and I think the political translation of that is what you saw with Kerry in Moscow, you know, a week or so, 2 weeks ago, namely that the U.S. position is, it's not just softened, because I think that sort of understating what's happening here. Yes, of course, the U.S. position on regime change has softened, but the Russian, you know, involvement in this war, I think, has really exacerbated the tensions that already existed, the divides that were already becoming ever more clear in terms of the U.S. Military, political, and intelligence establishments, because, you know, since the Russians have gotten involved, now you have the Obama administration, Obama, Kerry, those around them, his national security team, the rest of them, they're now much more apprehensive about taking any provocative moves inside of Syria, knowing that the Russians will counter move in some way that will be, of course, you know, have a deleterious effect on what the U.S. wants to do. On the flip side, this is now pushing the neocons in their sort of, you know, psychotic, rage-filled, you know, agenda to really push harder for U.S. military intervention, as we've mentioned on this show already a few times. John Bolton's article in the New York Times at the end of November, where he was arguing for the creation, led by the United States, I should add, the creation of a Sunni state, carving out a chunk of Syria and a chunk of Iraq to create a de facto ISIS-controlled Sunni state in the region. Of course, Petraeus talking about arming and funding and financing al-Qaeda to fight against ISIS, allegedly, but fight against the Syrian government. So that neocon position has also hardened and you know, calcified, I guess you could say, by the Russian involvement. And then I think that the third part of this is the CIA, the intelligence networks that have been in Turkey, funneling those weapons, pushing the Muslim Brotherhood to escalate the war and so forth. They probably also have their own conception of how this needs to be dealt with. And so in many ways, this complex imperial machine is in conflict with itself, and I think that we can thank Putin and the Russians for that.
Yeah, I mean, with the CIA, of course, you know, the world is their oyster. You've got probably, I'm guessing, but looking at history and not so recent history and not so distant history, you've got probably one guy with his, you know, talking to Assad, seeing if the CIA can make a deal with him, while another guy at the same time is trying to make a deal with one of the generals of Assad to kill him.
Oh, yeah.
While they're working to pressure from the outside, and well, you know, they basically want to play every angle that there is, and that's what they do best.
Don, I just want to note here real quick before we move on that not only that, I mean, I agree with all of that, but none of this has really been secret. That's the crazy thing. Yeah. I remember June 21st, 2012, and I know the date because I've literally referenced this probably 1,000 times in almost every article I've ever written about Syria in the last 3 years, that the New York Times documented in June of 2012, the headline was CIA said to steer arms to Syria rebels. Okay. Right. And it clearly, and you know, in very plain language, explained how the CIA was based along the Syrian Turkish border and working with the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood to arm and finance and train and fund all of these so-called rebel factions inside of Syria. Now we're talking mid-2012, only, you know, about a year into this war is when the New York Times reported that. Now that means, of course, that program had been ongoing for quite a while if the New York Times had picked up the story. So in effect, then, the CIA has been doing this from the very beginning and is most likely heavily involved in fomenting the so-called uprising that initiated this war in the first place. And so, yes, not only is the CIA playing every angle, the CIA is intimately involved in literally every aspect of this conflict from its very genesis.
Yep, I agree with that. I'm sure that that's true. So from the original incidents on the ground, for example, how did the peaceful protesters get the wherewithal to attack military and military bases and police stations with weaponry?
Yeah, look, Don, you and I mean, you, because you have a lot more years of experience than I do, but you and I have probably collectively been to thousands upon thousands of protests in our time of activism, and I've never seen an armed protester. I don't think such a thing exists. There can be a protest, and then you can have militants embedded in that protest. And from all of the reports, including Western media reports, I might add, from that time, which I have, you know, saved because I knew that they would be important, those reports indicate that in the very first protests in the city of Dera in March of 2011, that not only did they turn violent because the security forces used violence, but that they actually turned violent because certain individuals embedded in those protests were firing at police. There were weapons caches that were discovered inside mosques and community centers nearby where the protest was taking place. Now, if this sounds eerily familiar to people, it should, because that's exactly what happened in Ukraine on Maidan. That's exactly what's happened a number of times since Syria, since 2011. And we can see a repeated pattern of this same template for destabilization being replayed over and over and over again. Now, to me, you know, with my, I guess, conspiratorial mind, if you will, that to me smacks of a CIA playbook.
Well, let's see. You had the same thing happen in Caracas in 2002.
Yeah, exactly.
And in 2013, when the 43 people were killed.
2002, the original coup, in 2013.
So it was actually early 2014, I think, when the actual incident took place. But yeah, and the same thing that happened in Benghazi at the beginning of the Libyan episode and in so many other places. With the idea, obviously, that what you're looking to do is provoke a response from the state that will inflame the situation and antagonize the people against the government. You know, on the point about going to protests, being older, the first ones that I went to were Vietnam, okay? And back then, what you used to do to make a sign, a picket sign, literally picket, was a picket off a picket fence. It was a piece of wood, you know, long and skinny, that you would staple your placard to. You can't bring those to protests anymore. You can only have papers now, like the tubes from wrapping paper or whatever, or the police arrest you on the spot, let alone carrying machine guns around. You can't even carry a wooden stake for your protest sign anymore.
Not only that, you can't even, well, at least in New York City, I know it's different elsewhere, but you can't even use a megaphone.
Well,
we're not even talking weapons, or, you know, we're not even talking about a piece of wood that could theoretically be used as a weapon. We're talking about, you know, something that amplifies your voice. You're not allowed to use. So, again, I mean, your point is well taken, Don, because, you know, the kind of leap in logic one has to take to believe that armed individuals at a protest, where there were truly, of course, obviously unarmed people, but armed people inside of that protest, means that is no longer a protest.
Right, that's right. I mean, look, unarmed protesters don't shoot back.
Yeah, exactly. And unarmed protesters... unarmed protesters surrounding armed militants,
right.
We might as well not call them unarmed protesters. We might as well call them human shields.
Right, that's right. All right, so that's what's going on in Syria. And they're going to be meeting, I guess, you know, it's a week and a half, 2 weeks away from when they should start convening the peace talks in Syria.
I thought it was January 25th. Am I wrong?
No, so that's about 4 weeks. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's January 25th. So they're just about a little under a month away. But it's important because, just reminded me, I don't know if it's a tweet from the infamous douchebag Ken Roth of the Human Rights Watch. Can I say douchebag on here? I think you can.
Yeah, you just did.
The Human Rights Watch is Ken Roth, who tweeted, who has, this wonderful habit of tweeting the most insanely ridiculous garbage about Syria and this fixation with barrel bombs that he has. But
let me say something before you go in, by the way. I saw something go by today that reminded people that Ken Roth has been in charge of Human Rights Watch longer than the so-called dictators that he complains of ruling their countries for 23 That's years good. Or something. So
that's good. I didn't even think about that. That's true. Yeah. But Ken Roth tweeted that the strike against Alush, I'm paraphrasing it, of course, that the strike against Alush was yet another example of Assad's brutality because it forces, trying to force people to choose between Assad and ISIS. Mm-hmm. Now, think about the implications of that statement, because not only is that, of course, tacit approval of everything that al-Nusra and all of the non-ISIS factions
have done.
But it illustrates how Ken Roth, and when I say Ken Roth, of course, I mean the U.S. Intelligence establishment, the State Department, particularly, those echelons of power that from which Ken Roth and his ilk come from, how they view this conflict, because basically the way that they see this is everybody but ISIS is good and okay,
right,
and should be defended and should be supported. Never mind the documented evidence by the Associated Press that Alusha's organization, Jaish al-Islam, was literally caging civilians and putting them on top of buildings to prevent the Russians from conducting airstrikes against them, that they were involved in almost every form of war crime imaginable. None of that matters to Ken Roth, to the State Department, or to the rest of these lunatics.
Nope, it's true. And by the way, the argument that they're making about that group is exactly the same argument you could make about Al-Qaeda.
Well, and they do.
Yeah.
And they do. They make this. They make a similar argument about al-Nusra Front. I've seen Ken Roth tweet about that, basically that, al-Nusra Front's not really all bad, that they've only, that it's only like rhetorically they've sworn allegiance to al-Qaeda, that really the evil and the villain is Assad. I mean, it's, look, it's the same thing over and over again. I'm not saying that it's necessarily newsworthy. I find it very interesting the way that this is now being framed by the political establishment. In other words, that Assad and the Syrian government are doing this not because they're fighting their war, but because they're trying to affect politically the nature of the negotiations, which I think is fundamentally wrong. I think that the Assad government, anybody who's been following this from the beginning knows, the Assad government has been involved in every form of peace talk that has taken place since 2012 when we first met in Geneva. Okay, so the Syrian government has really never opposed negotiations. They've only opposed who gets to be a part of them. Yeah. And I think that this is important because the idea that this entire operation was carried out in order to change the complexion of the negotiations, I think, is absurd. That's not how military operates. That's not how intelligence operates. And that's not what we've seen throughout the course of this war.
Well, I mean, the primary demand that the Syrian government has made with respect to who gets to, who they'll sit at the table with, is that they be Syrian and that they be self-directed, not proxies for some foreign power. In other words, this is a Syrian problem to the extent that's the part we're concerned about. The rest of it is terrorism or an illegal war. And we that is for the United Nations to deal with and for you people that are funding the terrorists. We Syrians want to sit down and talk. You're Syrian. You're Syrian. You're a Qatari. Get out of here. You're an American. Get out of here, et cetera. That's their demand.
But even that, just to be clear, the Syrians have never demanded that the United States not take part in this process.
For sure. They understand the reality of it, that if the United States doesn't sign on, it doesn't stop.
That's what I'm saying, is that they've been, I think, to a large extent, really accommodating about who gets to be involved. The you know, to use this overused phrase, the red line that Syria has drawn has been that outright terrorists who are waging war against civilians are not legitimate political partners for a dialogue.
Well, they're saying, we'll talk to Paul Winchell, not Jerry Mahoney, basically. Right. So
I don't know. I think we have probably like 15 or so minutes. You want to do Latin America? You want to do Africa? What do we want to do?
You know, let's do Africa. I would love to do Latin America, and maybe next week we'll do that.
Because let me just say, before we move to Africa, I mean, I mentioned it, but since I brought it up, I just want to say very quickly, we're recording here on December 27th. So the next time that we record this, what is that? January?
Either the 2nd or 3rd, yeah.
3rd, right. So that's 2 days before the right-wing assembly takes their seats in Venezuela.
Right.
There's going to be major fireworks in Venezuela in the coming days, and that needs to be watched very, very closely.
Yeah.
There is a major shift happening in Latin America right now where we've seen a rightward shift as Macri has taken power in Argentina, having won that election very narrowly. Of course, right shift in Venezuela, the attacks on Dilma Rousseff's government in Brazil, all of this is happening, but there is a whole backdrop to this that needs to be examined closely, and I guess maybe we'll do that next week. For instance,
now, let me just say, we're seeing a foreshadowing of what's going to happen in Venezuela this coming week, already happening in Argentina for like the last 6 days now.
Yeah, well, I mean, do you want to explain what that means?
Yeah, people have been in the streets. So there were some initiatives taken by Macri since he came into office. It's been about 10, 12 days since he took office, I guess. The first had to do with currency revaluation, basically, deregulation, which led to 40% devaluation, I think, of the currency, which provoked immediate response, and also basically deregulating the media, allowing private media to suck everything up, and attacking the public media directly. And the people have been out massively in the streets over this already.
Well, and what's interesting, and I don't want to take too much of our time away from what we wanted to talk about at the end here, but very quickly, I just want to say that this illustrates the clear difference between what's happening in Latin America and what we have in for instance, in the United States. In the United States, there's really only one political consensus. It has two parties that it controls, and the differences between them are very minor. I mean, you know, there are some, but they're not that significant in the grand scheme of things.
So
in Latin America, it couldn't be more opposite, where the two sides, the right wing, which is of course U.S. backed, and in Venezuela's case U.S. controlled, that the right wing and the, let's call them, left wing, whether socialist or social democratic forces, are distinctly different and in clear opposition to them. And what you saw in Argentina illustrates the danger of left sectarianism in Latin America, because Macri won that election, the runoff election, by I think 2% at the most,
very close.
And you had elements on the left in Argentina who were abstaining from the vote because they didn't like Cristina Fernandez's social democratic course that wasn't leftist enough for them, it wasn't pure enough for them, or whatever, and because of that they lost that election. That tells you that I think the danger of left dogmatism and doctrinaire thinking in Latin America, because as soon as you open that door a crack, you know what the United States does. They'll kick in the door, they'll come in, they kill your family, and they set fire to the house.
Hey, it's Trotsky. But then one of the things that's interesting about this is the landscape of Latin America is such that, you know, one contradiction that I noticed, I was talking with Tony Solo last week about it. You have the devaluation of the currency, okay? And the geopolitical, you know, reason for that from the point of view of the puppeteer, you know, here in Wall Street or wherever, is that, you know, the exports from Argentina are cheaper now. To, you know, they can buy them cheaper, whatever it is, commodities, beef, wine, you know, whatever. But the contradiction is, of course, that the market here is, you know, we're still broke. So we ain't buying it. Even if it's cheaper, we're not going to buy more of it. We're buying what we can afford already. So what it means is the people that have money, these exports become more attractive to. Guess who that is? It's China. So what they end up doing as the United States directs them to make, you know, their exports more American friendly is boost the share of the market. This is going to happen with China. And you've seen, you know, the project that was kicked off by Chavez, I would say Castro and Chavez, a long time ago, where the integration took primacy over ideology, that the, you know, the economic necessity of integration and the political necessity of asserting sovereignty against the United States primed ideological differences. And so you had right-wing governments across the region that are still involved in the economic and even, I would say, political and cultural integration project. So as Argentina, you know, as the right comes to power in Argentina and the Argentine bourgeoisie looks around, do they want to go back to being vassals of the United States, or would they like to see further development of this 600 million person market with themselves well placed as, you know, the boss instead of the vassal?
Well, it depends, because it depends what aspects of the Argentina's bourgeoisie, to use that term,
right,
what aspect of it or what segment of it we're talking about. If you're talking about, you know, industrial exporters, those who actually manufacture goods and sell them on the world market, I agree with you. But of course, there is, of course, the finance capital angle, and the finance capitalists are pretty much more or less proxies of Wall Street.
For sure.
And they, of course, have a significant amount of sway in that country as well. And I think a good example of that is this ongoing saga between the government of Argentina, or the, you know, it was the government of Cristina Fernandez,
right,
and Paul Singer,
the
hedge fund billionaire from Wall Street,
right,
who basically refused to take the deal that the Argentina had struck for debt restructuring a number of years ago, and basically tried to flex their muscle and, I would say, extort money out of Argentina. Now,
well, they didn't. Wait, let me just clarify something. He wasn't involved at that ab initio. Okay, he didn't like reject the deal at the time the deal was made. What he did was pick up scraps afterwards for pennies on the dollar and then go in and try to leverage that, which
well, that's
is
what
different.
Thank you. Yes, that's an important clarification. He bought low and tried to make a massive profit on it,
right,
which is how hedge fund operators and speculators,
right,
I mean, that's how they operate.
Right,
but
sure,
the point is, it was a direct assault against the sovereignty of Argentina and Argentina's government. And the reason I bring that up is because I think that there could be, just to your point that you just made, there could be an inherent tension within Argentina's bourgeoisie to that
right
effect.
Yeah, that's exactly where I'm going. And in addition to that, you have the population of Argentina generally is opposed to that hedge fund. I don't think you have very many people on the ground in a place where the right tends to be highly nationalistic and protective of its sovereignty there. Wall Street sucking blood money out of the Argentine economy. There's almost no sector. And we've had two votes at the United Nations General Assembly to get a sense of the world on that issue as well. So that's the political context that Macri is trying to push against.
Yep. No, exactly. I don't know. Now we have a few minutes left. Do you want to do Nigeria as quickly we can?
Let's stay on Latin America, and we'll do Africa and Latin America next week.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're right about that. And look, I mean, there's also a lot to be said for what's happening in Brazil right now, because you know the right wing commenced an impeachment process against Dilma, 2 months ago when they really started pushing it quite strongly
again this
and,
time, yeah.
And now it came out, and I have to admit, I haven't read the news in the last 72 hours, so I'm not sure what's happened since then. But it's come out that basically a judge ordered a halt, even though it's a temporary halt, on the entire impeachment process because of massive corruption and illegal activity committed by the right wing, which initiated the impeachment process in the first place.
Yeah. So, the leader of that, as a matter of fact, has had his assets seized by the Swiss.
Right. because they're criminals. That's the point.
Right.
These guys are in to a large extent international criminals. And again, just as in Argentina, just as in Venezuela and all throughout Latin America, a major segment of the ruling establishment in Brazil is controlled by the United States.
Right. Yeah, just for people to understand this, the guy who had Swiss bank accounts, the politician in the legislature, the lower house of the legislature, who has Swiss bank accounts that were actually seized by the Swiss over corruption allegations. Okay, they don't generally do that. That's the guy that's accusing Rousseff of corruption and seeking to commence an impeachment procedure in the house that he heads, which constitutionally doesn't have that power.
Well, and just to clarify, he already has done it. He's not just trying to impeach her. The impeachment has already begun. The legal process is happening, and a judge ordered a halt to it because of all this other stuff that's come out.
Yep, and the fundamental question of whether they have the authority to do it has also been addressed by the highest court there, and they said that only the upper house can commence that process.
Right, exactly. And so there's a number of legal issues here, and I just want to say in the time we have remaining as well, there is a major aspect to this, to the entire situation in Brazil that is very rarely discussed. I once saw a piece on Telesur about it, and that's probably the only place I've ever seen it. Basically, the entire protest movement against Dilma, which was, if you can believe it, calling for the military to depose the government, despite, of course, Brazil's nasty history of military dictatorship backed by the United States. But that segment that was out in the streets, particularly in Sao Paulo, that was calling for basically Dilma's head on a pike, they were really whipped up by the right-wing media. Now it's come out that media is funded, not the media, but various NGOs active in the media are funded directly by the worst reactionary forces in the United States, including the Koch brothers, including Rupert Murdoch. These are the types of individuals that are bankrolling the right in Brazil that are trying to destroy Dilma's government.
You know, if you look at it, too, you've had the presidential election in Argentina, the legislative, the National Assembly election in Venezuela, and the move against Dilma Rousseff in Brazil. If you look at each of these countries as, say, as a brick, Venezuela at the heart of ALBA, which is at the heart and at the heart of Mercosur, at the heart of Petrocaribe, you know, at the heart of CELAC, the ALBA countries at the heart of UNASUR. You know, and Argentina being one of the largest, certainly the most mature economy in the region and a potential engine of industrialization and the recipient of, for example, a nuclear power plant from the Russians and the one of the points of where the Chinese goods are going to be dropped off for the Transcontinental Railroad. Very key player. And Brazil, of course, which is the member of this consolidating region that is on the global stage as the B in BRICS. They're all key targets of the rising multipolarity. If you're going to take it down, those are three to take it, and that's where this stuff is happening.
That's right, and also it's where there have been significant inroads that have been made, and where a lot of the media is still controlled by private interests by the right wing, by the United States. And so there is a lesson, I think, of course, to be learned in all of this. And it's not, you know, I've had this debate endlessly with people about Chavez and why didn't Chavez just expropriate all these people and he would have avoided all of these problems that Venezuela has now. I think it's more complicated than that. But it is an important question to ask and for all of us to be thinking about exactly what Latin American countries should do to prevent this kind of destabilization by the United States. Now, Castro himself has said that the Cuba model for of 1959, 1960, 1961 is not going to be applicable to Latin American countries in the 21st century. So if that's not going to work, and the course that Chavez laid out for Venezuela, some people object to because of the where it's led the country in terms of this continuing conflict with the right-wing bourgeoisie, what exactly is the alternative development model for Latin America? And the reason I say that is because it is, in effect, what you're getting at here. It is integration for Latin America within the region, but then more broadly, integration of Latin America as an independent actor within the global economy. Brazil is a member of the BRICS, not simply because Brazil has a high GDP, because Brazil has a developed transnational corporate system and whatever. It is because Brazil is making significant inroads in Africa, throughout Latin America, in the Caribbean, and really in a number of parts of the world. They are on the world stage. Latin America is increasingly becoming on the world stage, and the shift away from the U.S. backyard to independent actor, that is why these countries are in the crosshairs.
And on that note, we'll leave it off here, and maybe we'll pick it up next week in the same spot on the question that you raised.
Beautiful. Thanks, Don.
Eric, thanks a lot. Pleasure as always.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for another edition of CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar. Tune in again next week. Thanks for listening.